vastly different personality than when awake, the two halves having no knowledge of each other.
"Gentlemen, it's most difficult to credit," says Beringer, "but stranger things have happened."
"Nature sometimes produces two heads on one body," says Dupont. "Then why not two persons, as it were, in one brain? There may exist examples not only of alternating states of consciousness, as claimed by Puysegur, but of two distinct personalities which may coexist in the same body and yet have different sets of memories altogether, and be, for all practical purposes, two separate individuals, if, that is, you'll accept a debatable point, that we are what we remember."
"Perhaps," says Simon, "we are also, preponderantly, what we forget."
"If you are right," says Reverend Beringer, "what becomes of the soul? We cannot be mere patchworks. It is a horrifying thought, and one that, if true, would make a mockery of all notions of moral responsibility, and indeed of morality itself, as we currently define it."
"The other voice, whatever it was," says Simon, "was remarkable for its violence."
"But not without a certain logic," says Beringer dryly, "and an ability to see in the dark."
Simon remembers Lydia's warm hand and finds himself flushing. At the moment he wishes Beringer at the bottom of the sea.
"If two persons, why not two souls?" Dupont continues. "That is, if the soul must be brought into it at all, or three souls and persons, for that matter, consider the Trinity."
"Dr. Jordan," says Reverend Beringer, ignoring this theological challenge, "what will you say about this in your report? Surely the evening's proceedings are scarcely orthodox from a medical point of view."
"I shall have to consider my position," says Simon, "very carefully. Although you do see that if Dr. Dupont's premise is accepted, Grace Marks is exonerated."
"To admit such a possibility would require a leap of faith," says Reverend Beringer. "One that I myself will pray for the strength to make, as I have always believed Grace to be innocent, or hoped, rather, although I must admit I have been somewhat shaken. But if what we have witnessed is a natural phenomenon, who are we to question it? The ground of all phenomena is God, and he must have his reasons, obscure though they may appear to mortal eyes."
Simon walks back to the house alone. The night is clear and warm, with the moon almost full, enclosed in a nimbus of mist. The air smells of mown grass and horse manure, with an undertone of dog. Throughout the evening he's maintained a plausible self-control, but now his brain feels like a roasting chestnut or an animal on fire. Silent howls resound inside him. There's a confused and frenzied motion, a scrambling, a dashing to and fro. What happened in the library? Was Grace really in a trance, or was she play-acting and laughing up her sleeve? He knows what he saw and heard, but he may have been shown an illusion, which he cannot prove to have been one. If he describes what he witnessed in his report, and if his report finds its way into any petition submitted on Grace Mark's behalf, he knows it would immediately scotch all possible chances of success. It's ministers of justice and their kind who read such petitions. They are hard-headed, practical men who require solid evidence. If the report were to become public and a matter of record and widely circulated, he would become an instant laughingstock, especially among the established members of the medical profession. That would be the end of his plans for an asylum, for who would subscribe to such an institution knowing it to be run by some crack-brained believer in mystical voices? There's no way he can write the report Beringer desires without perjuring himself. The safest thing would be to write nothing at all. But Beringer will hardly let him off the hook so easily. However, the fact is that he can't state anything with certainty and still tell the truth, because the truth eludes him. Or rather, it's Grace herself who eludes him. She glides ahead of him, just out of his grasp, turning her head to see if he's still following. Brusquely, he dismisses her and turns to thoughts of Rachel. She, at least, is something he can grapple with, take hold of. She will not slip through his fingers. The house is in darkness. Rachel must be asleep. He doesn't wish to see her. He feels no desire for her this evening, quite the opposite. The thought of her tense and bone-colored body, her scent of camphor and withered violets, fills him with a faint disgust. But he knows all that will change as soon as he steps over the threshold. He'll begin to tiptoe up the stairs, intending to avoid her. Then he'll turn around, make his way to her room, shake her, roughly awake. Tonight he'll hit her, as she's begged him to. He's never done that before. It's something new. He wants to punish her for his own addiction to her. He wants to make her cry, though not too loudly, or Dora will hear them and trumpet scandal. It's a wonder she hasn't heard them before. They've become increasingly careless. He knows he's reaching the end of the repertoire, the end of what Rachel can offer, the end of her. But what will come before the end? And the end itself, what shape will it take? There must be some conclusion, some finale. He can't think. Perhaps tonight he should abstain. He unlocks the door with his key, opens it as quietly as he can. She's there, just inside, waiting for him in the hall, in the dark, in her ruffled peignoir, which gleams wanly in the moonlight. She winds her arms around him and draws him inward, pressing against him. Her body shakes. He has an urge to beat her away as if she's a spider web across his face, or a skein of entangling jelly. Instead, he kisses her. Her face is wet. She's been crying. She's crying now. "Hush," he murmurs, stroking her hair. "Hush, Rachel." This is what he's wanted Grace to do, this trembling and clinging. He's pictured it often enough, though he now sees, in a suspiciously theatrical way. Those scenes were always skillfully lit, the gestures, his included, languid and graceful, with a kind of luxurious quivering, as in the death scenes at the ballet. Melting anguish is a good deal less attractive now that he actually has to contend with it up close and in the flesh. Wiping the doe-like eyes is one thing. Wiping the doe-like nose, quite another. He rummages for his pocket handkerchief. "He's coming back," Rachel says in a piercing whisper. "I've had a letter from him." For an instant, Simon has no idea who she means. But of course it's the Major. Simon has consigned him, in imagination, to some bottomless debauch or other, and then forgotten him. "Oh, what will become of us?" she sighs. The melodrama of the expression does not diminish the emotion, at least not for her. "When?" Simon whispers.
"He wrote me a letter," she sobs. "He says I must forgive him. He says he's reformed. He wishes to start a new life. It's what he always says. Now I must lose you. It's unbearable."
Her shoulders are shaking. Her arms around him tighten convulsively. "When is he coming?" Simon asks again. The scene he used to envisage, with a pleasurable prickling of fear, himself embedded in Rachel, the Major appearing in the doorway, all outrage and drawn sword, returns with new vividness. Come, says Simon. He leads her along the hall to her bedroom. Now that he knows his own escape from her is not only possible but necessary, he feels an intense desire for her. She's lit a candle. She knows his tastes. The hours remaining to them are few. Discovery looms. Panic and fear are said to quicken the heartbeat and heighten desire. He makes a mental note to himself. It's true. As for perhaps the last time, he pushes her backward onto the bed and falls heavily on top of her, rummaging through the layers of cloth.
"Don't leave me," she moans.
"Don't
leave me alone with him. You don't know what he'll do to me."
This time her agonized writhing is real.
"I hate him. If only he were dead."
"Hush," whispers Simon. "Dora may hear." He almost hopes she does. He feels, at this moment, in great need of an audience. Around the bed he ranges a shadowy assemblage of watchers, not only the Major, but the Reverend Verringer, and Jerome Dupont, and Lydia. Above all, Grace Marks. He wants her to be jealous. Rachel stops moving. Her green eyes open and look straight into Simon's.
"He doesn't have to come back," she says.
The irises of her eyes are huge. The pupils are mere pinpricks. Has she been taking laudanum again?
"He might have an accident, if nobody sees him. He could have an accident in the house. You could bury him in the garden."
This isn't impromptu. She must have been making a plan.
"We couldn't stay here. He might be found. We could cross to the States on the railway train. We'd be together then. They'd never find us."
Simon puts his mouth on hers to silence her. She thinks this means he's consented.
"Oh, Simon," she sighs. "I knew you would never leave me. I love you more than my life."
She kisses his face all over. Her movements become epileptic. It's another of her scenarios for inducing passion, in herself above all. Resting beside her shortly afterwards, Simon tries to picture what she must have been imagining. It's like some third-rate shocker, Ainsworth or Bulwer Lytton, at their most bloodthirsty and banal. The Major reeling drunkenly up the front steps, alone in the dusk, then entering the front hall. Rachel is there. He strikes her, then clutches her cringing form with sottish lust. She shrieks and begs for mercy. He laughs like a fiend. But rescue is at hand. There's a sharp blow with the spade on his head from behind. He falls with a wooden thud and is dragged by the heels down the passageway to the kitchen, where Simon's leather satchel awaits. A quick incision to the jugular with a surgical knife, blood gurgles into a slop bucket, and all is over. A spate of digging in the moonlight, and into the cabbage patch he goes, with Rachel in a becoming shawl and clutching a dark lantern, and swearing she will be eternally his after what he's dared for her sake. But here is Dora, watching from the kitchen door. She cannot be allowed to escape. Simon chases her around the house, corners her in the scullery, and sticks her like a pig, with Rachel trembling and fainting, but then pulling herself together like a true heroine and coming to his aid. Dora requires more digging, a deeper hole, followed by an orgiastic scene on the kitchen floor. So much for the midnight burlesque. Then what? Then he'll be a murderer, with Rachel as the only witness. He'll be wedded to her, chained to her, melded to her, which is what she wants. He will never be free. But here's the part she has surely failed to imagine. Once they're in the States, she'll be incognito. She'll be without a name. She'll be an unknown woman of the kind often found floating in canals or other bodies of water. Unknown woman found floating in canal. Who would suspect him? What method will he use? In bed, at the moment of delirium, her own hair coiled around her neck, only a slight pressure. That has a definite frisson. It is worthy of the genre. She'll have forgotten all about it in the morning. He turns to her again, arranges her. He strokes her neck. Sunlight wakens him. He's still beside her, in her bed. He forgot to return to his own room last night. No wonder he was exhausted. From the kitchen, he can hear Dora clattering and thumping. Rachel is lying on her side, propped on one arm, watching him. She's naked, but has twined herself in the sheet. There's a bruise on her upper arm, which he can't remember making. He sits up.
I must go, he whispers. Dora will hear.
I don't care, she says.
But your reputation, it doesn't matter,
she says. We'll only be here for 2 more days. Her tone is practical. She regards it as settled, like a business arrangement. It occurs to him, and why for the first time only, that she may be insane, or verging on it, or a moral degenerate, at the very least.
Simon creeps up the stairs, carrying his shoes and jacket like a naughty undergraduate returning from a romp. He feels chilled. What he's viewed as merely a kind of acting, she's mistaken for reality. She truly thinks that he, Simon, is going to murder her husband, and out of love for her. What will she do when he refuses? There's a swirling in his head. The floor under his feet seems unreal, as if it's about to dissolve. Before breakfast, he seeks her out. She's in the front parlor on the sofa. She rises, greets him with a passionate kiss. Simon detaches himself and tells her that he's ill. It's a recurrent malarial fever, which he contracted in Paris. If they are to fulfill their intentions, he puts it that way to disarm her. He will have to have the proper medicine for it at once, or he can't answer for the consequences. She feels his forehead, which he's taken the precaution of dampening with his sponge, upstairs. She's suitably alarmed, yet there's an undertone of elation as well. She's getting ready to nurse him, to indulge herself in yet another role. He can see what's in her mind. She'll make beef tea and jellies. She'll pack him in blankets and mustard. She'll bandage any part of him that sticks out or looks likely. He will be weakened. He will be enfeebled and helpless. He will be firmly in her possession. That is her goal. He must save himself from her while there's still time. He kisses the tips of her fingers. She must help him, he says tenderly. His life depends on her. Into her hand he presses a note, addressed to the governor's wife. It requests the name of a doctor, as he knows no one locally. Once she has the name, she must hurry to the doctor and obtain the medicine. He's written down the prescription in an illegible scribble. He gives her the money for it. Dora can't go, he says, as she can't be trusted to hurry. Time is of the essence. His treatment must begin immediately. She nods. She understands. She will do anything, she tells him fervently. White-faced and trembling, but with lips set, she puts on her bonnet and hurries away. As soon as she's out of sight, Simon dries his face and begins to pack. He sends Dora for a hired carriage, bribing her with a generous tip. While waiting for her return, he composes a letter to Rachel, bidding her a polite farewell, pleading the health of his mother. He doesn't address her as Rachel. He includes several banknotes, but no terms of endearment. He's a man of the world and won't be trapped that way. Or blackmailed, either. No breach of promise suit for him in case her husband dies. Perhaps she'll kill the major herself. She's more than capable of it. He thinks of writing a note to Lydia as well, but thinks better of it. It's a good thing he's never made a formal declaration. The carriage arrives. It's more like a cart. And he hurls his 2 valises into it. To the railway station, he says. Once he's safely away, he will write to Verringer, promising some sort of report, stalling for time. He may, after all, be able to work up something, something that will not entirely discredit him, but above all, he must put this disastrous interlude firmly behind him. After a quick visit to his mother and a rearrangement of his economies, he will go to Europe. If his mother can manage on less, and she can, he can just barely afford it. He doesn't begin to feel safe until he's in the railway carriage with the doors firmly shut. The presence of a train conductor in a uniform is reassuring to him.
order of a sort is reasserting itself. Once in Europe, he'll continue his researches. He will study the many prevailing schools of thought, but he will not add to them, not yet. He has gone to the threshold of the unconscious and has looked across, or rather, he has looked down. He could have fallen. He could have fallen in. He could have drowned. Better, perhaps, to abandon theories and concentrate on ways and means. When he returns to America, he will bestir himself. He'll give lectures. He'll attract subscribers. He'll build a model asylum with well-tended grounds and the very best sanitation and drainage. What Americans prefer above all is the appearance of comfort in any sort of institution at all. An asylum with large, comfortable rooms, facilities for hydrotherapy, and a good many mechanical devices could do very well. There must be little wheels that go around with a whirring sound. There must be rubber suction cups, wires to attach to the cranium, apparatus for measuring. He will include the word electrical in his prospectus. The main thing must be to keep the patients clean and docile. Drugs will be a help, and their relatives admiring and satisfied. As in schools for children, those who must be impressed are not the actual inmates, but those who pay the bills. All of this will be a compromise, but he has now, very abruptly it seems, reached the right age for it. The train moves out of the station. There's a cloud of black smoke, and then a long, plaintive wail which follows him like a baffled phantom along the track. Not until he's halfway to Cornwall does he allow himself to consider Grace. Will she think he's deserted her? Lost faith in her, perhaps? If she is indeed ignorant of last evening's events, she will be justified in so thinking. She'll be bewildered by him, as he has been by her. She can't know yet that he's left the city. He pictures her sitting in her accustomed chair, sewing at her quilt, singing, perhaps, waiting for his footfall at the door. Outside, it's begun to drizzle. After a time, the motion of the train lulls him to sleep. He slumps against the wall. Now Grace is coming towards him, across a wide lawn in sunshine, all in white, carrying an armful of red flowers. They're so clear he can see the dewdrops on them. Her hair is loose, her feet bare. She's smiling. Then he sees that what she walks on is not grass, but water. And as he reaches to embrace her, she melts away like mist. He wakes. He's still on the train, with the gray smoke blowing past the window. He presses his mouth to the glass. 14. The Letter X. April 1st, 1863. The convict Grace Marks has been guilty of a double, or may I say, Bible murder. Her boldness does not show that she is a sensitive person, and her want of gratitude is a convincing proof of her unfortunate disposition. August 1st, 1863. This unfortunate woman has become a dangerous creature, and I much fear that she will yet show us what she is capable of doing. Unfortunately, she has parties assisting her. She would not dare to lie as she does unless aided by parties near her. The Warden's Daybook, Provincial Penitentiary, Kingston, Canada West, 1863. Her exemplary conduct during the whole of her 30 years incarceration in the penitentiary, the later portion of which she spent as a trusted inmate of the home of the governor, and that so large a number of influential gentlemen in Kingston should think that she merited and deserved a pardon, all tend to show that there is room for grave doubts as to her having been the awful female demon incarnate that McDermott tried to make the public believe that she was. William Harrison, Recollections of the Kinnear Tragedy, written for the Newmarket Era, 1908. My letters, all dead paper, mute and white. And yet they seem alive and quivering against my tremulous hands which loose the string. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, Sonnets from the Portuguese, 1850. To Mrs. C. D. Humphrey, from Dr. Simon Jordan, Kingston, Canada West, August 15, 1859. Dear Mrs. Humphrey, I write in haste, having been summoned home most urgently by a family matter which it is imperative I respond to at once. My dear mother has suffered an unforeseen collapse in her always imperfect health, and is presently at death's door. I only pray that I may be in time to attend her in her last moments. I am sorry I could not stay to bid you farewell in person, and to thank you for your kind attentions to me whilst I was a lodger at your house. But I am certain that with your woman's heart and sensibility, you will quickly divine the necessity of my instant departure. I do not know how long I may be away, or, if indeed, I shall ever be able to return to Kingston. Should my mother pass away, I will be needed to tend to the family affairs, and should she be spared to us for a time, my place is by her side. One who has sacrificed so much for her son must surely deserve some not inconsiderable sacrifice from him in return. My return to your city in future is most unlikely, but I will always preserve the memories of my days in Kingston, memories of which you form an esteemed part. You know how I admire your courage in the face of adversity and how I respect you. I hope you will find it in your heart to feel the same towards your most sincere, Simon Jordan. P.S. In the attached envelope, I have left you a sum which I assume will cover any little amounts which remain outstanding between us. P.P.S. I trust that your husband will soon be happily restored to you. From Mrs. William P. Jordan, Laburnum House, Loomisville, Massachusetts, the United States of America. To Mrs. C. D. Humphrey, Lower Union Street, Kingston, Canada West. September 29, 1859. Dear Mrs. Humphrey, I take the liberty of returning to you the 7 letters addressed by you to my dear son, which have accumulated here in his absence. They were opened in mistake by the servant, which will account for the presence of my own seal upon them in place of yours. My son is at present making a tour of private mental asylums and clinics in Europe, an investigation very necessary to the work he is engaged upon, work of the utmost significance, which will alleviate human suffering, and which must not be interrupted for any lesser considerations, however pressing these may appear to others who do not understand the importance of his mission. As he is constantly traveling, I was unable to forward your letters to him, and I return them now, supposing that you would wish to know the reason for the lack of reply, although I beg to observe that no reply is in itself a reply. My son had mentioned that you might make some attempt to re-establish your acquaintance with him, and although he very properly did not elaborate, I am not such an invalid, nor so cloistered from the world that I was unable to read between the lines. If you will accept some frank but well-intentioned advice from an old woman, permit me to observe that in permanent unions between the sexes, discrepancies in age and fortune must always be detrimental. But how much more so are discrepancies in moral outlook? Rash and ill-advised conduct is understandable in a woman placed as you have been. I fully realize the unpleasantness of not knowing where one's husband may be located, but you must be aware that in the event of the demise of such a husband, no man of principle would ever make his wife a woman who had anticipated that position prematurely. Men by nature and the degree of providence have a certain latitude allowed them. But fidelity to the marriage vow is surely the chief requirement in a woman. In the early days of my widowhood, I found a daily reading of the Bible quite soothing to the mind, and some light needlework also helps to occupy one's thoughts.
In addition to these remedies, perhaps you have a respectable female friend who may comfort you in your distress without wishing to know the cause of it. What is believed in society is not always the equivalent of what is true. But as regards a woman's reputation, it amounts to the same thing. It is as well to take all steps to preserve that reputation by not spreading one's misery abroad, where it may become the subject of malicious gossip. And to that end, it is wise to avoid the expression of one's feelings in letters, which must run the gauntlet of the public posts, and may fall into the hands of persons who may be tempted to read them, unbeknownst to the sender. Please accept, Mrs. Humphrey, the sentiments I have expressed, in the spirit of a genuine desire for your future well-being, in which they are offered by, yours most sincerely, Mrs. Constance Jordan. From Grace Marks, the Provincial Penitentiary, Kingston, Canada West, to Dr. Simon Jordan. December 19, 1859. Dear Dr. Jordan, I am writing to you with the help of Clary, who has always stood my friend and got this paper for me, and will post it when the time comes in return for extra help with the laces and stains. The trouble is that I don't know where to send it, as I am ignorant of where you have gone. But if I find it out, then I will send this. I hope you can read my writing, as I am not much accustomed to it, and can only spend a short time at it each day. When I heard you went off so quick and without sending any word to me, I was very distressed, as I thought you must have been taken ill. I could not understand it, that you would go without a goodbye after all the talking we had done together. And I fainted dead away in the upstairs hall, and the chambermaid went into a panic and threw a vase of flowers over me, water vase and all, which quickly brought me round, although the vase broke. She thought I was going off into fits and would run mad again, but this was not the case, and I took very good control of myself. And it was just the shock of hearing about it in that sudden manner, and the palpitations of the heart which I have often been troubled from. I suffered a gash on my forehead from the vase. It's astonishing what a great quantity of blood may flow from a wound to the head, even if it is a shallow one. I was unhappy that you left, as I was enjoying our talks. But also, they said you were to write a letter to the government on my behalf to set me free, and I was afraid that now you would never do so. There is nothing so discouraging as hopes raised and then dashed again, as it is almost worse than not having the hopes raised in the first place. I do very much hope you will be able to write the letter in my favor, which I would be very thankful for, and hope that you are keeping well. From Grace Marks. From Dr. Simon P. Jordan, care of Dr. Binswanger, Bellevue, Kreuzlinger, Switzerland, to Dr. Edward Murchie, Dorchester, Massachusetts, the United States of America. January 12, 1860. My dear Ed, forgive me for having taken so long to write to you and to acquaint you with my change of address. The fact is that things have been somewhat muddled, and it has taken me some time to straighten myself out. As Burns has remarked, the best-laid schemes o' mice and men gang aft agley, and I was forced to make a hasty escape from Kingston, as I found myself in complicated circumstances which could rapidly have become quite damaging both to myself and to my future prospects. Some day over a glass of sherry I may tell you the whole story, although it seems to me at present less a story than a troubled dream. Among its elements is the fact that my study of Grace Marks took such an unsettling turn at the last that I can scarcely determine whether I myself was awake or asleep. When I consider with what high hopes I commenced upon this undertaking, determined, you may be sure, on great revelations which would astonish the admiring world, I have cause almost for despair. Yet, were they indeed high hopes and not mere self-seeking ambition? From this vantage point, I am not altogether sure. But, if only the latter, perhaps I have been well repaid.
As in the whole affair, I may have been engaged on a wild goose chase or a fruitless pursuit of shadows and have come near to addling my own wits in my assiduous attempts to unpick those of another. Like my namesake the Apostle, I have cast my nets into deep waters, though, unlike him, I may have drawn up a mermaid, neither fish nor flesh, but both at once, and whose song is sweet but dangerous. I do not know whether to view myself as an unwitting dupe or, what is worse, a self-deluded fool. But even these doubts may be an illusion, and I may all along have been dealing with a woman so transparently innocent that in my over-subtlety I did not have the wit to recognize it. I must admit, but only to you, that I have come very close to nervous exhaustion over this matter. Not to know, to snatch at hints and portents, at intimations, at tantalizing whispers, it is as bad as being haunted. Sometimes at night her face floats before me in the darkness like some lovely and enigmatic mirage. But, excuse my brain-sick ramblings, I have intimations of some vast discovery still. If I could only see my way clear, though, as yet, I wander in darkness, led only by marsh lights. Two more positive matters. The clinic here is run along very clean and efficient lines, and is exploring various lines of treatment, including water therapy, and might act as a model for my own project, should it ever come to fruition. Dr. Binswanger has been most hospitable and has given me access to some of the more interesting cases here. Much to my relief, there are no celebrated murderesses among them, but only what the worthy Dr. Workman of Toronto terms the innocent insane, as well as the usual sufferers from nervous complaints and the inebriates and syphilitics, although, of course, one does not find the same afflictions among the well-to-do as among the poor. I was overjoyed to hear that you may soon favor the world with a miniature copy of yourself through the kind offices of your esteemed wife, to whom please send my respectful regards. How calming it must be to have a settled family life and a trustworthy and dependable woman capable of providing it. Tranquility is indeed much undervalued by men, except those who lack it. I envy you. From Mrs. William P. Jordan, Laburnum House, Loomisville, Massachusetts, the United States of America, to Mrs. C. D. Humphrey, Lower Union Street, Kingston, Canada West. May 15th, 1862. Dear Mrs. Humphrey, your communication to my dear son came to hand this morning. I open all his mail nowadays, for reasons I will shortly explain. But first, permit me to remark that I could have wished you to express yourself in a less extravagant manner, to threaten to do yourself an injury by jumping off a bridge or other elevated location might carry weight with an impressionable and tender-hearted young man, but it does not with his more experienced mother. In any case, your hope of an interview with him must be disappointed. Upon the outbreak of our current lamentable war, my son joined the Union Army to fight for his country in the capacity of military surgeon, and was sent at once to a field hospital near the front. The postal services have been sadly disrupted, and the troops are moved about so quickly due to the railroads, and I had no word of him for some months, which was not like him, as he has always been a most regular and faithful correspondent, and I feared the worst. In the meantime, I did what I could in my own limited sphere. This unfortunate war had already killed and wounded so many, and we saw the results daily as yet more men and boys were brought into our improvised hospitals, mutilated and blinded, or out of their minds with infectious fevers, and every one of them a dearly loved son. The ladies of our town were kept thoroughly occupied in visiting them and arranging for them any little home comforts it was within our power to supply, and I myself aided them as best I could despite my own indifferent state of health, as I could only hope that if my dear son were lying ill and suffering elsewhere, some other mother was doing the same for him.
At last, a convalescent soldier from this town reported hearing a rumor that my dear son had been struck in the head by a piece of flying debris, and when last heard of had been lingering between this world and the next. Of course, I was almost dead with worry, and moved heaven and earth to discover his whereabouts, until, much to my joy, he was returned to us, still alive but sadly weakened both in body and spirit. As a result of his wound, he had lost a part of his memory. For although he recalled his loving parent and the events of his childhood, his more recent experiences had been completely erased from his mind, among them his interest in lunatic asylums, and the period of time he spent in the city of Kingston, including whatever relations of any kind he may or may not have had with yourself. I tell you this that you may see things in a broader, and I may add, a less selfish perspective. One's own personal doings look small indeed when faced with the momentous travails of history, which we can only trust are for the greater good. Meanwhile, I must congratulate you on the fact that your husband has been at last located, although I must also commiserate with you on the unfortunate circumstances. To discover that one's spouse has passed away due to prolonged intoxication and the resulting delirium cannot have been at all pleasant. I am happy to hear that he had not yet exhausted his entire means, and would suggest to you, as a practical matter, a dependable annuity, or, what has served me quite well during my own trials, a modest investment in railway shares, if a solid company, or else in sewing machines, which are sure to make great progress in the future. However, the course of action you propose to my son is neither desirable nor feasible, even should he be in any condition to entertain it. My son was under no engagement to you, nor is he under any obligation. What you yourself may have understood does not constitute an understanding. It is also my duty to inform you that before his departure my son became as good as engaged to be married to Miss Faith Cartwright, a young lady of fine family and impeccable moral character, the only obstacle remaining being his own honor, which prevented him from requesting that Miss Cartwright bind herself to a man whose life was so soon to be imperiled. And despite his damaged and at times delirious state, she is resolved to respect the wishes of the two families, as well as those of her own heart, and is at present helping me to nurse him with loyal devotion. He does not yet remember her in her proper person, but persists in believing that she is called Grace, an understandable confusion, as faith is very close to it in concept. But we persevere in our efforts, and as we daily show him various little homely objects once dear to him, and lead him on walks through local spots of natural beauty, we have increasing hopes that his full memory will shortly return, or at least as much of it as is necessary, and that he will soon be well enough to fulfill his marital undertakings. It is the foremost concern of Miss Cartwright, as it should be for all those who love my son disinterestedly, to pray for his restoration to health and the full use of his mental faculties. In closing, let me add that I trust your future life will be more productive of happiness than has been the recent past, and that the evening of your life will bring with it a serenity which the vain and tempestuous passions of youth so often, unfortunately, if not disastrously, preclude. Yours most sincerely, Mrs. Constance P. Jordan. P.S. Any further communication from you will be destroyed unread. From the Reverend Enoch Verringer, Chairman, the Committee to Pardon Grace Marks, Sydenham Street Methodist Church, Kingston, Ontario, the Dominion of Canada. 2. Dr. Samuel Bannerling, M.D., The Maples, Front Street, Toronto, Ontario, the Dominion of Canada. Kingston, October 15, 1867. Dear Dr. Bannerling, I presume to write to you, sir, in connection with the committee of which I am chairman,
upon a worthy mission which cannot be unfamiliar to you. As the former medical attendant upon Grace Marks, when she was in the Toronto Lunatic Asylum almost 15 years ago, I know you have been approached by the representatives of several previous committees charged with submitting petitions to the government on behalf of this unfortunate and unhappy, and to some minds, wrongly convicted woman, in hopes that you would append your name to the petitions in question, an addition which, as I am sure you are aware, would carry considerable weight with the government authorities, as they have a tendency to be respectful of informed medical opinion such as your own. Our committee consists of a number of ladies, my own dear wife among them, and of several gentlemen of standing, and clergymen of 3 denominations, including the prison chaplain, whose names you will find appended. Such petitions have in the past been unsuccessful, but the committee expects, as well as hopes, that with the recent political changes, most notably the advent of a fully representational parliament under the leadership of John A. Macdonald, this one will receive a favorable reception denied to its predecessors. In addition, we have the advantage of modern science and the advances made in the study of cerebral diseases and mental disorders, advances which must surely tell in favor of Grace Marks. Several years ago, our committee engaged a specialist in nervous ailments, Dr. Simon Jordan, who came very highly recommended. He passed a number of months in this city in making a detailed examination of Grace Marks, with particular attention to her gaps in recollection concerning the murders. In an attempt to recover her memory, he subjected her to neurohypnosis at the hands of a skilled practitioner of that science, a science which, after a long eclipse, appears to be coming back into favor both as a diagnostic and as a curative method, although it has thus far gained more favor in France than in this hemisphere. As a result of this session and the astonishing revelations it produced, Dr. Jordan gave it as his opinion that Grace Marks's loss of memory was genuine, not feigned, that on the fatal day she was suffering from the effects of a hysterical seizure brought on by fright, which resulted in a form of auto-hypnotic somnambulism, not much studied 25 years ago but well documented since, and that this fact explains her subsequent amnesia. In the course of the neurohypnotic trance, which several of our own committee members witnessed, Grace Marks displayed not only a fully recovered memory of these past events, but also pronounced evidence of a somnambulistic double consciousness, with a distinct secondary personality capable of acting without the knowledge of the first. It was Dr. Jordan's conclusion, in view of the evidence, that the woman known to us as Grace Marks was neither conscious at the time of the murder of Nancy Montgomery nor responsible for her actions therein, the memories of these actions being retained only by her secondary and hidden self. Dr. Jordan was of the added opinion that this other self gave strong manifestations of its continued existence during her period of mental derangement in 1852, if the eyewitness reports of Mrs. Moody and others are any indication. I had hoped to have a written report to set before you, and our committee has delayed the submission of its petition from year to year in expectation of it. Dr. Jordan had indeed fully intended to prepare such a report, but he was called away suddenly by family illness, followed by urgent business on the continent, after which the outbreak of the Civil War, in which he served in the capacity of a military surgeon, was a serious impediment to his efforts. I understand he was wounded in the course of the hostilities, and although providentially now making a recovery, has not yet regained sufficient strength to be able to complete his task. Otherwise, I have no doubt that he would have added his earnest and heartfelt entreaties to ours. I myself was present at the neurohypnotic session referred to, as was the lady who has since consented to become my dear wife, and both of us were most profoundly affected by what we saw and heard. It moves me to tears to think how this poor woman has been wronged through lack of scientific understanding.
The human soul is a profound and awe-inspiring mystery, the depths of which are only now beginning to be sounded. Well, may St. Paul have said, now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. One can only guess at the purposes of our Creator in fashioning of humanity such a complex and Gordian knot. But whatever you may think of Dr. Jordan's professional opinion, and I am well aware that his conclusions may be difficult to credit, for one not familiar with the practice of neurohypnosis and who was not present at the events to which I allude, surely Grace Marks has been incarcerated for a great many years, more than sufficient to atone for her misdeeds. She has suffered untold mental agony, and agony of body as well. And she has bitterly repented whatever part she may have taken in this great crime, whether conscious of having taken it or not. She is by no means any longer a young woman, and is in but indifferent health. If she were at liberty, something might surely be done for her temporal as well as her spiritual weal, and she might have an opportunity of meditating on the past and of preparing for a future life. Will you, can you, in the name of charity, still persist in refusing to join your name to the petition for her release, and thereby, perchance, close the gates of paradise to a repentant sinner? Surely not. I invite you, I beg you, once again, to aid us in this most praiseworthy endeavor. Yours very truly, Enoch Verringer, M.A., D., Div. From Dr. Samuel Bannerling, M.D., The Maples, Front Street, Toronto, to the Reverend Enoch Verringer, Sydenham Street Methodist Church, Kingston, Ontario, November 1, 1867. Dear Sir, I acknowledge receipt of your letter of the 10th of October and its account of your puerile antics in regards to Grace Marks. I am disappointed in Dr. Jordan. I had some previous correspondence with him in which I warned him explicitly against this cunning woman. They say there is no fool like an old fool, but I say there is no fool like a young one, and I am astonished that anyone with a medical degree would allow himself to be imposed upon by such a blatant piece of charlatanism and preposterous tomfoolery as a neuro-hypnotic trance, which is second in imbecility only to spiritism, universal suffrage, and similar drivel. This rubbishy neuro-hypnotism, however beribboned with new terminologies, is only mesmerism, or animal magnetism, rewrit. And that sickly nonsense was discredited long ago as being merely a solemn-sounding blind, behind which men of questionable antecedents and salacious natures might obtain power over young women of the same, asking them impertinent and offensive questions, and ordering them to perform immodest acts without the latter appearing to consent to it. So, I fear that your Dr. Jordan is either credulous to an infantile degree, or himself a great scoundrel, and that should he have composed his self-styled report, it would not have been worth the paper it was written on. I suspect that the wound of which you speak was incurred not during the war, but before it, and that it consisted of a sharp blow to the head, which is the only thing that would account for such idiocy. If Dr. Jordan keeps on with this disorderly course of thought, he will soon belong in the private asylum for lunatics, which, if I recall aright, he was once so set upon establishing. I have read the so-called testimony of Mrs. Moody, as well as some of her other scribblings, which I consign to the fire where they belong, and where they for once cast a little light, which they certainly would not have done otherwise. Like the rest of her ilk, Mrs. Moody is prone to overwrought effusions, and to the concoction of convenient fairy tales, and for the purposes of truth, one might as well rely on the eyewitness reports of a goose. As for the gates of paradise to which you refer, I have no control whatever over them, and if Grace Marks is worthy to enter there, she will doubtless be admitted without any interference on my part. But certainly the gates of the penitentiary will never be opened to her through any act of mine. I have studied her carefully, and know her character and disposition better than you can possibly do. She is a creature devoid of moral faculties,
and with the propensity to murder strongly developed. She is not safe to be entrusted with the ordinary privileges of society, and if her liberty were restored to her, the chances are that sooner or later other lives would be sacrificed. In closing, sir, allow me to remark that it ill becomes you as a man of the cloth to pepper your screeds with allusions to modern science. A little learning is a dangerous thing, as I believe Pope once observed. Busy yourself with the care of consciences, and with the delivery of edifying sermons for the improvement of public life and private morals, which God knows the country is in need of, and leave the brains of the degenerate to the authorities who specialize in them. Above all, in future, be pleased to desist from pestering with these importunate and ridiculous appeals. Your most humble and obedient servant, Dr. Samuel Bannerling, M.D. 15. The Tree of Paradise. But persistence at last met with its reward. One petition after another went into the government, and doubtless other influences were brought to bear. This almost unique malefactor received a pardon and was conveyed to New York, where she changed her name and soon afterwards married. For all the writer of these lines knows to the contrary, she is living still. Whether her appetite for murder has ever strongly asserted itself in the interval is not known, as she probably guards her identity by more than one alias. Author unknown. History of Toronto and the County of York, Ontario, 1885. Friday, August 2nd, 1872. I visited the city from 12 to 2 to see Minister of Justice about Grace Marks, whose pardon I received this morning. It was Sir John's request that I and one of my daughters should accompany this woman to a home provided for her in New York. Tuesday, August 7th, 1872. Examined and discharged Grace Marks, pardoned after being imprisoned in this penitentiary 28 years and 10 months. Started with her and my daughter for New York at 1 p.m. by order of the Minister of Justice. Notes from the Warden's Daily Journal, Provincial Penitentiary, Kingston, Ontario, the Dominion of Canada. So with this earthly paradise it is, if ye will read aright and pardon me, who strive to build a shadowy isle of bliss, midmost the beating of the steely sea, where tossed about all hearts of men must be. William Morris, The Earthly Paradise, 1868. The imperfect is our paradise. Wallace Stevens, The Poems of Our Climate, 1938. I have often thought of writing to you and informing you of my good fortune, and I've written many letters to you in my head, and when I've arrived at the right way of saying things, I will set pen to paper, and thus you will have news of me if you are still in the land of the living, and if you are not, you will have learnt about all this anyway. Perhaps you heard of my pardon, but perhaps you did not. I didn't see it in any of the newspapers, which isn't strange, as by the time I was finally set free, it was an old, worn-out story, and nobody would have wanted to read about it. But, no doubt, that was just as well. When I learnt of it, I knew for certain that you must have sent the letter to the government after all, because it got the results in the end, along with all the petitions, although I must say they took a good long time about it, and said nothing about your letter, but only that it was a general amnesty. The first I heard of the pardon was from the warden's oldest daughter, whose name was Janet. This would not be a warden you ever saw, sir, as there were many changes since you went away, and a new warden was one of them. And there had been two or three new governors as well, and so many new guards and keepers and matrons I could scarcely keep track of them. I was sitting in the sewing room, where you and I used to have our afternoon talks, mending stockings, for I continued to serve in a household capacity under the new governors, as I'd done before, when Janet came in. She had a kind manner, and always gave me a smile, unlike some, and although never a beauty, she'd managed to become engaged to a respectable young farmer, for which she had my heartfelt good wishes. There are some men, especially of the simpler kind, that prefer their wives to be plain rather than handsome, as that sort buckles down to work and complains less, and there is not a great chance of their running off with another man, as what other man would go to the bother of stealing them? On this day, Janet hurried into the room, and she seemed very excited. "Grace," she said, "I have the most astonishing news." I did not even bother to stop sewing, as when people told me they had astonishing news, it always concerned somebody else. I was ready to hear it, of course, but not ready to miss a stitch over it, if you see what I mean, sir. "Oh," I said. "Your pardon has come through," she said.